Hello and welcome to The Week at Work. My name is Glenn Fitzpatrick and I'm here with my co-host Michelle Byrne. As always, we will have a look at the weekend papers and stories of the week from a left perspective. The Week at Work is part of Left Block, which is a political education and media project. You can find more information and support us on patreon.com/leftblock. That's block without the K. So this week, as I said, my co-host here, Michelle, we're going to take a deep dive into some of the big stories. You can probably guess what they are. Michelle, how are you getting on? How's your weekend started?
Well, this weekend, starting off with obviously huge protests in Dublin for Palestine, which is, you know, it's great to see that back happening after last week having to be cancelled off the back of the violence and the unrest that was happening in the city centre last week. And of course, that's just to the benefit of a lot of the people who want to spread hate and division anyway, that things like that, progressive causes like that would have to shut down in order to kind of, you know, out of fear, out of worry about what could have kicked off. So good to see that the protests are back up and going, and hoping that there's big turnouts today and across towns and cities, particularly that this week was marking the UN Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. Of course, this week is also important when it comes to the discussion around Palestine, because, you know, we've this, you know, the so-called truce that took place for 7 days has now ended. There's been, the Israeli military have now started absolutely bombing the whole Gaza Strip. There's no place now that is safe really for a lot of Palestinians, and that's what we're seeing from Palestinian people themselves saying that. And like some of the figures are quite shocking. You know, we're looking at 15,200 people dead now. In the day that the truce ended, in the 24 hours that the truce ended, we saw 193 Palestinians killed and 650 wounded in the 24 hours. So this is really scary. We're seeing, again, journalists being targeted and killed. We're seeing, like, there's reports now that 70% of the people who are killed are actually women and children. So, you know, all this demonization of Palestinian men and Arab men in all of this kind of messaging. But I think it's important to point out the fact that actually 70% of people that are being killed are women and children. For all of the people who say, oh, they want to protect women and children and all of that, is absolutely, absolute lies, just indiscriminately bombing whole areas of Gaza at this point. And alongside that as well, we're reading about, you know, how Netanyahu has now pulled out of ceasefire talks in Qatar. Of course, they're blaming Hamas for not fulfilling an agreement around hostages. But at the same time, you know, like, Israel are the ones who've actually captured more Palestinian people as hostages during this ceasefire than they actually released. You know, talking about, and during this ceasefire as well, you know, they're putting tons of these restrictions on civilians. You know, you're not allowed to go to this part of Gaza, you're not allowed to do this. They were shooting at people trying to leave hospitals and trying to go home during the ceasefire. So was it really a ceasefire in one way? Because it was still violence and people being injured and shot on the ground. Very, very worrying. And, you know, when you look at some of the Palestinian hostages that Israel released, you know, you're talking about, five of them were 14 years old. Most of them were under 17. Some of them, 10 of them were like women who'd been kidnapped and held hostage for over 6 years. You know, these 240 Palestinian prisoners that were released were never charged with any offence. You know, most of them are children between like 14 to 17 years old and who were kidnapped. And I think there's like a wider piece there, because, you know, in the media, you know, we're talking about these children who are being released and seeing the, you know, the videos of people running to their mothers and in tears. But we're not recognizing, like, why these aren't prisoners. They haven't been tried of any offense. These are hostages. And why does Israel have so many hostages? And why have they had hostages for, you know, we're talking years here, over 6-7 years. And I think that's a conversation that's been just kind of glossed over a little bit. You know, it was all very well recorded that Hamas took on hostages for leverage on October 7th. But we're not talking about the thousands of people in Israeli jails, the Palestinian people in Israeli jails that are locked up without trial. But yeah, so obviously now we're hearing that the bombardment has commenced again. we're talking, the Israeli military are talking about, you know, evacuation areas and like moving people out from other areas. But I'm seeing from Palestinian people on the ground that there is no other places for them to go. So this is kind of like a misnomer that they're kind of pushing them out. And then obviously we've seen absolutely horrendous video footage the last week. We're seeing videos of 9-year-olds being shot by the Israeli military. We're seeing babies in rubble turned to dust. And we're obviously, you've heard about the horrible scenes in the hospital where tiny babies were left to die on incubators, starving and alone because the Israeli military had forced the doctors out of the hospital. It's just shocking, really, that still it's like, you know, that things are still going on as if everything is normal when these kind of things are happening in the world, you know. And then when you see like just stupid pushback from the Ciaran Carla not flying the flag of Palestine on the UN Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people, or the same happened in Waterford as well, where it was refused to be flown in that day when it's been flown for the last 2 years. You know, look, there was other councils that put up the Palestinian flag, and like, what's a flag in all of this, you know, when considering everything that's happening? And can we really, what else can we do? Like, you know, there's so much happening in the space, and it's not going to let up. And I think it's important to remind people that we can't let up. It's weeks now going on and we can't keep the pressure off, and we need to keep the pressure on. And it's great to see feedback on the streets, and also more direct action and more boycott campaigns happening, where we can actually, you know, hit decision makers where the pressure lies, and where the money lies as well. I think it's really important.
Yeah, I mean, I can't disagree with anything you've outlined there, and I think it is super important for us to keep our collective foot on the pedal as much as we can. I think even though there's definitely a conscious effort in the press to kind of try and pour cold water on it, I think, you know, anybody who refuses to put a flag up above a building, or the same people who say we shouldn't expel the diplomats, like, they're all wound up in this total like recreation of, I suppose, the character and the persona of Micheál Martin, who all of a sudden has emerged as like this absolutely meticulous and dynamic diplomat who's, you know, getting Irish people out of a war zone, and who is, you know, over, you know, with all the movers and shakers in the Arab world. And apparently he is like, you know, the saving grace. It feels a little bit like how, you know, Bertie Ahern was able to kind of cloak himself in being in the right place at the right time during the Good Friday Agreement being signed. And it's like, now it's like, oh, look, here's our new age statesman. It's Micheál Martin. And this is like this is his crowning moment in politics, that he's announced himself as, you know, the Department of Foreign Affairs, the Minister for Foreign Affairs. And he's this absolutely amazing diplomat. And anybody who's out on the street or looking for a Palestinian flag to be flown, you know, be careful what you wish for, because you're just going to worsen our image in that space, and you're going to scupper his diplomatic efforts, which are so crucial. But I think Palestinians, you know, on the ground, they want us outside the US embassy. They want us to expel our diplomats, and they understand very well that, you know, it's important to isolate Israel on the international stage. So I think it's important that we keep the pressure on, and we push through the noise. And there was this completely, you know, new reinvention of Micheál Martin. But I think it's just on the media side of things, like, I think it's really, really clear that Israel is causing obviously so much destruction, but they're definitely losing the propaganda war. And I think there's definitely been a watershed moment, particularly in America. Like, I mean, even the New York Times has been forced to report that the freed Palestinians, they were mostly young, and they hadn't even been convicted of any crimes. BBC has obviously looked at the IDF reports of the Hamas tunnels with a lot more of a critical eye than I think a lot of people would have expected. So if Israel is having a tough time convincing the New York Times and the BBC to stick to a particular editorial line, like, that's a red flag that they've definitely lost the propaganda war.
Yeah, absolutely. And that picture of the hostages being like released and, you know, shaking hands with the Hamas person and having a joke and having a smile and a laugh, like, it's, you know, it really kind of shows like the contrast when you see people being released by the Israeli military who can't walk, who've been tortured by the looks of it, or like in just the comparisons. I think, yeah, it's very hard to not lose the communication war when you're looking at two by side, you know, even on that example.
Yeah, and look at this again. It's not a defense of Hamas or a romanticization of them, but obviously Israel's latest thing is to draw this illusion between like Hamas equals ISIS, and you know it's obviously a rhetorical device that they're hoping people will just sort of look at these people and sort of think that they're bereft of any humanity. But then you see a hostage from Hamas being released, and she still has her little pet with her, whereas you know. Palestinian kids being released, and they may have had a limb broken if they're lucky, in some regards. So a lot of the time, you're wondering when they say these things about the other side, like how much of it is actually just projection, or is it or if it's an admission, you know. But the blowback, I mean, Al Jazeera throughout their coverage has been, you know, pretty critical of the West and of America in this, but they're noting now as well, like just because of. There's been like a watershed moment in Palestine solidarity in US civil society. Obviously, it's not replicated in the political spaces, but in like key swing areas like Michigan, for example, which has a lot of Arab traditionally Democrat voters, like Biden support has just absolutely tanked. I think, and there's been a crescendo all week long of like, you know, realization that Trump is the favorite at the moment. But I think it's important thing that you know they mightn't come out and vote for Trump, but like Biden's just not going to be able to get those people to come out and support the Democrats next time. So I just think it's there's definitely been a watershed moment across like U.S. civil society, but obviously then you get into the House of Congress and like they're basically still equating anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism and poor Rashida Tlaib is singing a lonely song there in Congress. But there's a little bit of a split coming between the I suppose the pro-ceasefire side of the Democrats and the neocons, which are obviously on hiding to nothing in terms of like the election next year. Obviously, not that a Trump presidency would be any better for the people of Palestine, but I think it does demonstrate that the popular support for Palestine right across the globe is just growing and growing and growing. And I suppose political establishments here or in Washington just don't necessarily know how to handle it.
Yeah, it's an interesting one to watch because like obviously media have a big role in all of this and have a big role in a lot of political commentary. Like particularly I'm kind of even making the comparison of what's happened in the last week in Dublin after the riots. You know, we saw and like at home we saw RTE platforming the likes of John McGurk from Gripped.ie as, you know, and this is someone that their main aim has mostly been to stir up hatred against immigrants and LGBT people and any other minorities. And then, you know, even more recently, they've had to do a payout of public money over lies that he's spread, even on that kind of angle. But now he's back online again, and you know, and in this last week, he's also been involved in leading to the wrong person being identified as the man involved in the knife attack now, and that person's now under protection for their own safety. You know, so there's a load of backtracking happening there, and there is a responsibility of, you know, publicly funded media like our mainstream, our RTE, all of that. Like, you know, we've had lots of conversations about that here, but like, you know, you wonder about the responsibilities, the editorial responsibilities that are happening as well. And then you have Pádraig Tobin from Aintu on discussing the far right when he's mostly aligned to all of them as if he's some sort of like alternative person to the far right. You know, he's worked alongside John McGurk from Gripped and other far right individuals on campaigns, whether it's to stop sex ed in schools or whipping up hate against trans people or other LGBT people in general. You know, they also had the far right conspiracy theorist and racist Anto Boyle on Matt Cooper on about the attack as well, as if he's some sort of as if he's not attached to any of this at all. Like, and then you have, you know, the likes of maybe he hasn't been platformed in the same way by RTE or the likes, but you know, you've Conor McGregor then using social media to incite hate to say that we're at war and all of that. But actually interesting. Yeah, I just find the role of the media in actually platforming some of these voices as responders to what's happened here is really problematic. Giving them a platform, giving them legitimacy, giving them like that's kind of saying like, oh yeah, sure, like the next time something like this happens again, sure we'll get all of these hate leaders on give them a platform and giving them exactly what they want. it's just very concerning. And I think we need to kind of have a think about what the approach is there.
Yeah, the hubris is some of them is quite unbelievable to be honest with you. Like on one hand, like when obviously the tragic events of last week happened and the riots that ensued, you know, you get people kind of jumping to the defense of mainstream media saying, oh, make sure you use your trusted sources, make sure you're getting your information from reputable organizations. And you know, fair enough, yeah. I mean, like, you know, we should all try to do that insofar as they're reputable, but like these so-called trusted sources are also, as you quite well allude to, the same entities that have held the door open, have normalized the far right, have given them a platform, have failed to call them out on their bad faith. I think it's that last one for me is the failure to call out bad faith when it's so clearly there. There's a piece there this morning that RTE uploaded saying, in a world of misinformation, getting it right is crucial. And it was almost like a plea to grift, to like act in good faith, to do good journalism, to adhere to the standards of the Press Council. And apparently it's as important for alternative media to do that as mainstream media. So, you know, sort of inherent in that is like RTE is obviously an authority on what good faith is and good journalism is. But there's almost kind of like this, it's almost like a plea from like the liberal center to grift, just play by the rules, just be one of us, they're almost like they want grit to come into that mainstream space and to, you know, basically act like they all do. It's a really interesting piece, to be honest with you, from a number of angles. So in the piece itself, it looks at like there's some input from the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, which has done like kind of a expose on mis and disinformation in Ireland. So I think they had looked at it across like 9 different topics, including like the Russian war in Ukraine, which, look, that's a conversation for another day. But I think it kind of shows sometimes how like these think tanks and even like notions of fact checking can kind of get pulled into, you know, geopolitical, you know, kind of narratives, and, you know, that sometimes can compromise them as well. Because, you know, it can be quite selective then in terms of, well, you know, you end up thinking that all of the disinformation comes from one side when it obviously can exist on both. But Grift actually, in the piece itself, criticised the Institute for Strategic Dialogue by pointing out that it's one of its funders at the Open Society Foundation, which is obviously George Soros's entity. And it's kind of dismissed out of hand as like, oh, that's like not necessarily a valid criticism. But the thing is, like, I think one of the reasons why some elements of the far right have managed to like take some of the space of the left will traditionally operate in is because, like, looking at like who funds a think tank or, you know, to whose benefit the work is done, like, that is a valid like question to ask, but it's a question that could and should be asked from the left. And I think things like, you know, entities like the mainstream media, like the European Union, even like NGOs, like the left has kind of just given the far right a monopoly on criticizing a lot of these things, you know. So, you know, obviously NGOs here, like, they can and do good work, you know, and that's absolutely fine in that. But then the impact of NGOs in the Arab world, for example, where like they've sometimes created wedge issues and, you know, they've gotten funding from multinationals that have been involved in regime change operations, like NGOs like aren't an assumed good either. And I think the left's analysis has to like get much more razor sharp when it comes to the mainstream media, when it comes to the EU, when it comes to NGOs, because otherwise, like, it's just like the far right will take those criticisms and kind of twist them towards their own ends. And that's when they start talking about globalists and great replacement and stuff like that, and how apparently, you know, the mainstream media and the NGOs are all wound up in this. I think that the juxtaposition of our talking about Palestine today and talking about the stuff that's been happening in Ireland over the last couple of weeks, like the mainstream media is like really like right at the core of both of those stories, how it responds to it, but also then how it reflects on its own role, you know, in and of itself. Like, so, yeah, I mean, obviously we say at the start of the podcast, we're, you know, a political education project, and I think it's, you know, really important that like we appreciate that the media landscape is a frontier, and as well as reviewing the stories of the week, we should critically analyze the performance, the role of the media. And the last thing I'll say, and this is, it used to do this itself, like when the BBC used to be like a half decent, or at least used to aspire to like public service broadcasting, they used to have a show on a Saturday. I can't remember the name of it, but it would literally be like a look at the week's stories, and they'd be like, Oh yeah, you had the story on about a strike, but you didn't talk to somebody from the union side of things. So they would actually critically look at how did we do as a media service this week. Obviously, none of that is there anymore. So yeah, I shall turn off the
topic. If only we were to be so lucky to have something like that. But like kind of just picking up as well, you know, around like the role of the media and everything, and obviously like social media is now almost an extension of all of that. And we saw how that was used to kind of whip up hate, whether it's through Telegram channels, whether it's through Twitter or whatever. And like, as I mentioned, like Conor McGregor coming out and saying, you know, we're at war. And I think it's like, and now today I read that he's trying to twist Bernadette Devlin's words to support his own hateful cause around immigration. But like, as listeners will know, that we've had recently, only I think it was about three podcasts ago, had a pod about Bernadette and how she stands very strongly against hate. But I think that the line that he's like, we're at war, is interesting that he used that, like, because, you know, it's not, in a way, like, we are at war, but not in the way that Connor's on about, you know, we're actually at a class war here. You know, the ruling class are winning. They're using racism and hate to cause division amongst the working class, and like fanning the flames of hate by using terrible policies and kind of bits in the media that they're saying. And I think, you know, now we're looking at, and I spoke about it, we spoke obviously about the riot that happened last week in Dublin in last week's pod, and I mentioned about, you know, Waterford as well have an issue, but it's actually concerning to see the rise of hate in many communities and how it's been framed, and now there seems to be a bit of a playbook. So like, even in the last week I was reading that in Rosslare, and some people might be familiar that there's been quite a lot of protests in Rosslare about another asylum seeker centre that's been built there. There was a suspected petrol bomb attack this week in Rosslare. Like, that's the kind of level of violence we're talking about now. It burnt out a forklift. And at the same time, you have these concerned residents who are doing a 24/7 watch on the property. They've already blockaded Europort. You know, there's protests happening, seeing, like, you know, going down the road or whatever. But it's something that I find interesting in a lot of this, because, you know, it's the same with Leitrim as well. Leitrim is another example this week where we've seen, you know, the department said they're going to meet people down there, but there's hope for 155 people to move into a former hotel there. And the line that I keep hearing being said is, you know, it's not about racism, it's about resources. And there might be some truth in that, you know, that there is a resource issue and our communities have been squeezed of resources. But that's a wider policy piece that's bigger than, you know, who's moving into your community or not. And, you know, I think it's quite rich to say, oh, it's not about racism, it's about resources, when at the same time, the same people have never actually actively campaigned for resources in their community. Where have the protests been to, you know, build more homes, to build more, you know, to have more community centres? Where have all of those actions been? And also in the case of the Leitrim example, and it's not the first time that there's been hate whipped up in a town in Leitrim, but you can say that it's about resources, but then why is there three citizen checkpoints being set up around asking people for people's passports? Because that's not about resources. That's not about resources at all. That is racism. Wanting to know where do people have ID, what their business is in this area. That's making people feel unsafe and unwelcome, and it's intimidation. That has nothing to do with lack of resources in the community. So I think this like misnomer, like while there is definitely, and this is how a lot of like the far right messages gain popularity, because there's often an element of truth in the message, and that's what people hold on to. But if you look at the wider piece here, why haven't those people been out before calling for more resources? Why are people being checked for their IDs? And why is this all happening around direct provision centres and not around vulture funds, or like not around anything else? You know, there's so many other targets. And why are people targeting the people who are vulnerable, who are seeking asylum in this country? It's completely based around racism in that way. But not to tire everyone and say that they're racist, because obviously there is resource implications there. People are feeling the, you know, years of austerity and years of terrible policy, neoliberal policy making. And that is a valid concern and that should be heard. But there needs to be a way of redirecting this hate that has now been directed in the wrong direction. You know what I mean? It needs to be organized, and we need to be organized. And I always say this all the time, we need to be organizing our communities towards the right direction, like to where actually the problem can be solved.
Yeah. And I think it's, I haven't seen so much of it recently. I think there was definitely in the run up to like the Eastwell instance last year, and that is like there were some people kind of dismissing out of hand that like, oh, why are all these people so angry? And that, I mean, I think the absolute crux of it is to realize that there is legitimate community and working class anger at resource scarcity. And you can't just like say that anger is not legitimate, and it is about redirecting it in the places that it should go. But I think it's, you know, at the community level, like we know what the game is now. I'm sure you've seen it like online, like a lot of the bile is like very anti-left, particularly like anti-socialist. I mean, obviously like Mary Lou McDonald's car was blockaded there a few days ago as well. They're not necessarily turning up at Pascal Donoghue's door, although I believe he might be off the IMF soon. But I think it's very clear if you go into like some of the conversations on Twitter where like people are talking about politics or alternatives or the Shinners or whatever, it's like it's all very much like keep the left out, sure they're the ones that supported the open border policies, you know. But it's very much like, and there's a good piece on The Ditch there today, which basically looks at how the likes of Conor McGregor and Grip just kind of basically, they act the rebel and they, you know, they cloak themselves in this rebellious language, but it's really a Trojan horse for the status quo, because as you say, they're not offering solutions to this resource scarcity at all. In actual fact, I mean, that, you know, the history books have shown us, like, you know, sort of these reactionaries will fall back down on the side of capitalism all day long. And they can, in one fell swoop, they can go from saying something like, oh, the government must go, to, oh, watch out for the loony left. And they're, you know, it's very, very plain to see, I think. And it's about having those conversations with people about, well, you know, at the level of, well, what are the solutions and which solutions are they offering here? But I think we have our work cut out, and obviously the local elections next year kind of give them a frontier to, or an excuse to produce materials and to go knocking on doors, you know?
Yeah, and like, speaking of elections, because obviously I feel like there's definitely an air of election mode been switched on the last while with, you know, the local and Europeans coming up. And as you say, obviously we've had it in Waterford already, where there's Irish Freedom Party candidates in the city centre and stuff. But alongside that, you know, Sinn Féin are also trying to position themselves into, you know, a place where they want to be in the next government. Obviously, that's a big part of a lot of what's been happening at the moment. And I just thought, I was actually quite concerned around something, a tweet that Mary Lou McDonald put up during the week around the response. It was around the riots and what's happening in Dublin and stuff like that. But, you know, putting up a picture of a vulnerable person who probably has an addiction issue, potentially homeless, who knows? There's a man drinking a can on a step nearby where the knife attack happened. And it was kind of like to say, oh, I think she said something along the lines of, you know, oh, we've learned nothing from the policing. Policing haven't learned anything from what happened last week. But, you know, taking a picture of someone drinking a can on a step in the middle of city centre, like, is just disgraceful. I actually couldn't believe it. To see that, you know, putting that kind of shame and stigma on someone, and maybe trying to link the fact that anyone who sits around and drinks a can in the inner city of Dublin is linked to the violence that happened there, or like, I don't know, I just thought it was an absolutely inappropriate way to highlight any sort of issue, whether it's a policing issue or a social issue. She wasn't even highlighting the fact that this man is probably, you know, has been failed by the state already and maybe potentially needs someone who needs help. I just think it's shocking to see, like, is that how Sinn Féin is going to approach social issues then? Like, that is to put shame and stigma. And like, how does that fare for people who do need support when their state has failed them, you know, whether it be addiction or drug policy? You know, I am a bit worried about that, because that's all stuff that's been, you know, discussed at the moment. Or, you know, I just really feel like that, you know, trying to pander to this kind of like centrist voter of like, oh, maybe Sinn Féin can be the new party of law and order. I just think it's absolutely bizarre to try and take on Fine Gael and nearly match or outdo them in that with this tweet. And the mad thing is, the tweet is still up. The photo is still up. I checked this morning. I just don't know how that was, like, where they're going with that calculation. I just really think that Sinn Féin should just stick to, you know, sharing solutions to actual problems, that the root causes of a lot of the issues of, like, all this division, all this hate, all this classism is around addressing housing, addressing health, addressing the inequality issues. Stick to providing the solutions and not shaming and stigmatizing failures of the state, which they hope to be in government and they hope to lead. So like, if that's how they're going to take their leadership role and into that direction, I'd be very concerned. But yeah, I just thought I just had to point it out because I just still in shock that it's actually still up, to be honest.
Well, it's not, I mean, it's not still up by accident. Like it's not like somebody took a day off and decided to not log in social media and take it down. And no, completely agree. And it, you know, when she gets to speak out on these things, or you know, if the potential Taoiseach in waiting is going to say things, and you can be damn well sure that they put a lot of thought into what it is she's going to say. You know, talking about, you know, across the country people don't feel safe kind of language, that's obviously strategic on their part. And you know, it does feel that they're pivoting to that kind of, you know, reactionary law and order position, as you say. And I mean, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't see how it can work for them, because if you're appealing to the typical person who likes the concept of the Fine Gael law and order party, hates Sinn Féin anyway, so they're not going to vote for you. And then you're going to be hemorrhaging votes on the left from people who, or maybe just transfers, from people who, you know, don't buy into Fine Gael's, I suppose, concept of law and order anyway. So, I mean, we've seen it before, like this kind of rush to the centre, and you end up losing weight on both sides. The more and more I kind of like feel about the next general election. Anyway, I don't see how Sinn Féin get nearly enough to be like a significant majority party. I mean, they might end up in with Fianna Fáil, but like, I don't think they're going to hit 60 seats at this stage. And I think, as well as that, then like if people do want more law and order. And actually, as the piece in the ditch this morning alludes to as well, like a lot of the reactionaries, like and a lot of the kind of the anti-immigrant sentiments, like a lot of that is still the backbone of, you know, large chunks of Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil anyway. So I sort of sense that Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil between them might have enough even to keep the Shinners out next time again. And, you know, unless the Shinners go back to the drawing board very quickly and kind of figure out where their head is at with some of this stuff, like I've spoken to people this week who said, like, I don't even know if I could give them the preference now after, you know, if this is the kind of the trajectory that they're on, you know what I mean? Like, obviously PTSD, what's that? PRSTV, that's the one. That, you know, ultimately you have to kind of vote for the least worst anyway, but like, you don't like the thought of like, Soc Dem or PVP or independent left voters going to the ballot box and giving the Shinners like a 4 or a 3 through gritted teeth. It should be a pretty straightforward decision. Like if you're on the left and you're not voting for Sinn Féin 1, there should be at least your second preference. But I think they're creating difficulty for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And just there talking about, we've referenced the ditch now a couple of times, but there's actually a couple of other stories that I wanted to touch on as well that they covered. And I just want to say, like, fair play to them, because, like, you know, the news of the withdrawal of their funding from the web summit, who obviously would just rather, you know, that the status quo be upheld and unquestioned. They've really kind of pushed back on that and just continue to put out some really good investigative work. Like, apart from that kind of that analysis that you referred to, Glenn, about the far right and everything, we also have some really good pieces on housing. Like they had a piece this week where the Fine Gael junior minister Patrick O'Donovan was intervened in a planning case in Limerick City and County Council, which illegally reduced the development contribution levy by $140,000. So Limerick Council has been flagged before by the ditch and they didn't respond very well to it. So we'll see how that pans out as well. And then you have another story where you have Minister Helen McEntee, who's obviously been in the news quite a bit this week, but for other reasons, she's also been intervening in planning applications for a family friend and was using her ministerial title to actually, which and her intervention led to a development that was previously refused to be accepted. And then you have another story again in the last week, fair play to them, around they were talking about how they had previously reported about vulture funds buying up like hundreds and hundreds of properties. I think they said the last time they had reported on it in September, they had bought up the Vestry General Partner is a vulture fund that had bought 762 rental homes in September. And a couple of months later, as of this week, they have 1,030 homes that they've hoovered up. And one of the places they flagged that this vulture fund had bought up was a 2-bed in Finglas that for a year ago, they bought it for 250 grand. And now it's up for advertisement for nearly two and a half grand for a 2-bed rental a month. So this is just, you know, and it like, you know, and obviously amazing work by Dutch, fair play to them. And then at the same time, you have news that, you know, oh, average rents of new tenancies have now increased nationally by 11.6%, which is like the highest annual increase since the RTB series actually began in 2007. So, you know, people need to start adding up the dots, putting the dots together and actually putting policy to stop what's happening to be allowed to happen. Like vulture funds are destroying the city, they're destroying our communities and making our communities extremely unaffordable. And we talk about resources. We're talking about resources, like, you know, people being divided because of housing issues and, you know, hate being whipped up because of housing issues. It all goes back to, you know, who controls our communities right now, because it really looks like the vulture funds do.
Yeah, and just that those kind of stories and investigative work, like, kind of juxtaposed alongside a story here that I was reading this morning. I don't know if you saw in the Irish Times. It's quite a long form piece, but Jack Power and somebody else, sorry, but it's just looking at like just the build up of emergency accommodation in the North Inner City, particularly along Gardiner Street. So if people have a chance to have a read, it's well worth it. But it's I think there's a lot of places that you'd walk up Gardiner Street and you'd still think it's like B&B or touristy, but they're pretty much all emergency accommodation now. And I mean, I suppose like the individuals they've spoken to, the spaces that they're living in. But then towards the end of the article, it goes kind of down into who owns them. You know, you can sort of like there's 7 or 8 businessmen absolutely creaming it from emergency accommodation from the state, raking in millions. You know, so like there's winners and losers here, and just, as you say, it doesn't have to be like that. Sorry, yeah, that was just a small detour. I can't remember his name, but the second author of that article, but Jack Power was one of them. And it's just to look at the buildup of emergency accommodation in the North Inner City, and they've been given access to kind of go in and talk to people who've been living there. Obviously, you know, kids in there as well, pregnant women. And you know, that this is Ireland 2023. And again, don't hear any solutions from the far right in relation to that. Lastly on housing then, I think there's an issue with the Tathany House residents again, which has been reported on. And you know, a lot of them are fake accounts anyway, but the comments on Facebook, it's like they're obviously the far right solutions to these things. It's like, you know, oh, the landlord should be able to do whatever he wants with his property, or like, you know, why don't they go off and buy their own house kind of thing? Like, so, you know, ultimately the same people who are saying Ireland is full, they also seem to be in complete lockstep ideologically and policy wise with landlords, with developers. And you know, that should basically tell its own story.
Yeah, absolutely. And even going back to that whole piece around on another point around you know, who controls our communities and like our resources and everything, I don't know if many people saw it, but there was actually a data centers conference that's now an annual thing that's happened the last few years in Dublin in the RDS, and Minister Simon Coveney was speaking at it, of course, supporting the cause. But interesting enough, I think it was the day of when the riots actually kicked off. So while all of that was happening outside, you know, we had this data centre protest over here, and Extinction Rebellion Ireland protested at it. And, you know, some of their messaging was really interesting, because they talk about, you know, power communities and not big tech, and like that whole, like, bring it back to communities, because you're looking at like data centers using up a huge resources in energy and water. You know, you're talking about the size of multiple, you know, the same usage as big towns. And like, this has been reported quite a bit. And there was a point that was pointed out as well, where it was like, you know, only 19% of data that's stored in those centers is actually only critical, and the rest is actually useless data that will never be used. And any of the data that kind of useless data that is being held is used to, like, for audience advertising profiles or for advertising revenue and all of that stuff. So it goes actually go back to the whole thing about profit making. So we're just holding up these buildings just so people can create profit for no reason off the back of like using our resource of water and energy. So I think that was really interesting, you know. And another thing that they said actually as well was they talk about how, you know, not having climate action is actually killing people and like displacing people. And it goes back into that whole conversation again about, you know, people who need to seek asylum then off the back of the climate crisis. So everything is interconnected in a way. We're talking about resources, we're talking about community building, you know, resources for communities, and we're talking about energy, housing, and water. And no, like the far right are not providing any of those solutions. They're actually, as you say, calling out any of the issues where these are crunch points in Ireland, like DASH centres or vulture funds or anything like that. So I just thought it was an interesting one, but I don't think it got a whole lot of coverage. But I think, you know, there's just so many pedals to keep the foot on. And I think it's great to see the pressure being kept on the that angle as well around the climate crisis too.
Yeah, and it's obviously against the backdrop of the COP 28 climate summit happening in Dubai. Just heard this morning our esteemed Taoiseach giving a speech talking about Ireland's experience in relation to that. There's an interesting kind of piece in the Business Post online there yesterday by Daniel Murray, just like, just long story short, just sort of saying like, you know, time is kind of up for the UN in relation to climate, and that, you know, a year where global temperatures are expected to once again be the hottest on record. You know, you're basically that COP is still kind of stuck in language over whether they will, in inverted commas, phase down or phase out fossil fuels. And they're having to like co-agree, you know, language, which doesn't seem to be too many, you know, too much of a difference between phase down or phase out. But, you know, he's basically making the case that like whatever body of text they agree, that it would be ignored by those that it doesn't suit anyway. You know, so I mean, like I've no problem with the world's leaders going, even if they're all flying on private jets halfway around the world to talk about climate and that. But I mean, like, I think that last year was it 2026 or 2027 was supposed to be the big game changer. Was it in Glasgow or something? And obviously there hasn't been a game changer of any note.
No.
I definitely remember last year there was an awful lot coming out from like the Global South sort of saying, no, or some parts of the Global South were boycotting it, or they were calling on like the developed world to do more. And even that seems to be kind of like fade into the background this time. I'm not sure what.
Yeah, honestly, like a cop just is a bit of a cop out at this point. Like I read an article about, you know, the Saudis actually planning on conducting oil deals at COP. What are we even playing at? Like, what is the point of that conference? You know, you'd like to engage with it in good faith, but when you see stuff like that,
any good news?
Oh yeah, we actually have one bit of good news anyway, or like, you know, it's getting there, but it's off the back of bad news, so I don't know if it is good news. But like, we do like to finish up the podcast with something with a bit of hope in it, anyway. But something that I was reading during the week, and it's back to the story of Palestine, is that Starbucks have had to withdraw from the Moroccan market completely because of people avoiding the company because of their role, obviously, in their connections with Israel ties. So that's good news. And also there has been some reports of like up to 70% of a decrease in sales in some places, such as Starbucks, off the back of the boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign, the BDS campaign. So it is working, so keep it up. And, you know, I think a lot more people are aware of that. Like that BDS movement has been ongoing for years, and it's great to see now that people can like actively name the companies and are actively avoiding putting their money there to fund that will eventually like essentially fund support of apartheid regime. So I think that's really great, and people should continue to keep up the work there.
Deli, well, look, I mean, we've probably taken up enough of people's weekends at this stage, so we might cut it there, unless you got anything else you want to throw into the mix. No, well, listen, fair play on all of that. You can cover the hell of a lot of ground. So yeah, we'll wrap it up, I suppose. This has been The Week at Work. Hope you've gotten something out of our podcast this week. And remember, you can follow, subscribe, leave us a good rating. Obviously, all that kind of stuff helps getting the word out as well. Share podcasts, tell your friends about The Week Hats, and we'll be back with you next week. Take care.